Hey guys, welcome back to another episode of The Business of Cyber. My guest today is Michael Cortez from YL Ventures. If you're not familiar with YL, they're one of the leading cyber-focused VC firms. Now, Michael invests throughout the lifecycle of a company. So we cover things like his investment criteria, lessons he's learned from investing at the earliest stages of company formation, as well as common challenges he's experienced directly within his portfolio companies. So a huge thank you to Michael for joining me today and hope you guys enjoy the conversation.
Well, the party is off to a good start.
Michael, welcome to the show. Thank you so much for joining me today. How's it going?
Thanks, Joe. Happy to be here. Appreciate it. Yeah, going pretty well. How are you?
Doing well. Thank you.
Sure. So a good, easy question that I know the answer to get us started. So I appreciate that. So my name is Michael Cortez. I'm a partner here at YL Ventures, member of the investment team. I've been here coming up on 4 years now, which sounds a little bit crazy when I say it out loud, but it's true. Before joining YL, I was part of the investment banking team at Goldman Sachs here in San Francisco, where I'm based. I was part of a more generalist team at Goldman, so I worked on pretty much every type of deal that an investment bank does for a bunch of different types of companies. So it's everything from, you know, industrial sell sides to consumer retail credit facilities to biotech IPOs, everything under the sun. And before that, business school at UChicago. And then before that, a lifetime ago, I worked for a prop tech or a real estate tech kind of company called Home Junction. So a little bit of kind of operator experience, you know, grad school, a little bit of finance, and I've been doing early stage cybersecurity investing at YL for the past few years.
Very good. And when you initially joined YL 4 years ago and, you know, transitioned from Goldman, what were some of the, maybe the big things that you had to learn?
The big things that I had to learn? There's tons of things. You know, I think it's a little bit cliche, but it's cliche for a reason. I think a lot of venture boils down to pattern recognition, you know, whether that's patterns in business models, in markets, in founder profiles. So I would say it's a little bit of a cop-out, but I think it's a genuine answer. You know, a lot of it is just learning through doing and learning through watching, almost like osmosis. So one of the things I always say to people is, you know, this is the reason why I think board observer roles early in your career are so critical in VC, because you're not going to know how to handle every corner case. You know, you're not going to know how to respond to every emotional situation, positive or negative. You're not going to know the right answer to every question. But if you get enough reps and you see, I think, how other successful and insightful VCs whom you respect and other founders respond to successes and failures, I think you start to build a little bit of that pattern recognition and you develop a little bit of a muscle or kind of a sense for how to do that yourself. And so, again, it's a little bit of a cop-out, but I think there's really no substitute for this role. I think in some ways, maybe it's why founders in many cases make for good VCs having been through that, but I think there's no substitute for that experience and kind of, again, learning by doing and then learning kind of through watching.
And maybe just to dig into that a little bit and kind of get right into it. I know, you know, in your role within YL, you're, you know, participate in a number of boards. So, you know, as you reflect on the experience over the last 4 years, what have been some of those, you know, pivotal experiences or lessons learned, you know, as you just reflect on the 4 years thus far?
I think the important thing for me, I guess, from a career development perspective, you know, has been, I was sort of thrown into the fire pretty early, I think, at least from a board observer perspective. You know, within a few months, I had my first board observer role. And I think I'm really appreciative of that because, you know, the other partners here at YL, I think, knew that that was the best way to kind of ramp me up and the best way to see if I was capable or not. It was to just kind of throw me into the room, you know, the room where it happens, kind of to steal a line from Hamilton. And I think that, you know, I was able to do that very early. And I was able to also do that for a wide range of companies in terms of their maturity. So when I think about the things that I learned the most from, you know, I can think about one company called Medigate, which was sold last year to Clarity. Being a board observer of that company, working alongside our managing partner, Yoav, working with that amazing founding team, and kind of going through that experience, you know, tremendous growth and then an acquisition. You know, that was a fundamental experience, I think, for me in my career development. And then getting in this past year to be able to kind of lead my own deal, start to finish, you know, kind of take my first full board observer seats. Again, kind of tremendously valuable for me from a career development standpoint. So I think that being able to work with companies that are, you know, sort of at scale, you know, that are, you know, kind of tens of millions of dollars in ARR, hundreds of millions, if not billion dollar valuations, and then also being able to work with people when they've just got a kernel of an idea and there's nothing even built yet. You know, there's barely a PowerPoint deck, let alone an alpha product, right? And I think being able to juxtapose those experiences, you really get to feel like you're almost, in some ways, a founder yourself, but with a lot less, I guess, personal risk, or at least you're dispersing that personal risk. And so that's really fun. So I think for me, it's not necessarily one company, you know, although I mentioned Medigate, it's really that breadth of experience, you know, being able to work with companies at every stage of maturity that I think has been so helpful to me.
Yeah, sure. Okay. And what was it initially that drew you into an investing role? I'm curious to kind of understand that a little bit more before we get into some of the details of the process, or, you know, just more detail of the role at YL.
Yeah, for sure. And it's very different than what I was doing at Goldman, especially being so early, right? Like I'm not building a lot of LBO or models or DCFs when I'm doing seed stage security investing. But I think for me, it really comes back to, you know, that experience I had at Home Junction, that startup I alluded to prior to business school. You know, it was really a bootstrap company at the end of the day, and it was an amazing experience kind of seeing that, you know, take off. And when I decided to go to business school, you know, I was really interested in, or I thought I didn't really know anything about it at the time, but I thought I was interested in early stage venture really from the beginning, because I felt like it would be, or had the potential to be, I should say, a really fun and rewarding and sustainable career to be able to help people like myself, like my friend, you know, who I worked with, who was one of the early employees there, to be able to give kind of perspective and help for people that are trying to build their own thing. It just seemed like a fun job to be able to kind of, you know, do what I was doing, but from a different lens. You know, when I got to business school, Career Services basically said, you know, that's a cute idea, but nobody's ever heard of your startup. So I don't really think Andreessen Horowitz is going to be knocking down your door. So maybe you should go, you know, consider a safer career path, let's say. And so my thought process was, you know, if I can get into a place, an investment banking role in Silicon Valley, in San Francisco, you know, I can be close to it. I can be kind of learning a little bit of finance, and then hopefully I'll get another opportunity down the road. And when I, you know, decide, I kind of came to that critical decision point, you know, do I stay in investment banking and, you know, try to make MD or partner one day, or do I kind of go with my gut and take a leap and say, hey, if I want to try this as a career, now is the best and probably the only opportunity. And so I kind of took a leap. So I think it was always something I thought about or wanted to do going back to even before business school. And it was really after a couple of years of investment banking where I said, you know, it's kind of now or never.
Yeah. I'm curious to understand what the transition was like. I know you mentioned within at Goldman, you know, you kind of touched all of their different product offerings and, you know, did everything from, you know, large industrial deals to, you know, really covered the full spectrum, to now joining YL, where it was obviously doing something different, but hyper specialized on cyber investments, specifically for companies with, you know, a connection to Israel. So what was that transition like?
Yeah. I think hard in some ways and easy in some ways. You know, I think one of the things I'm very grateful for with respect to the experience at Goldman, you know, I think it teaches you kind of a way to think, a way to approach problems, and just sort of a level of professionalism that I think has broader applicability. You know, as I mentioned earlier, I was joking, you know, I don't do a lot of kind of deep financial analysis because these companies don't even exist yet. So there's not a lot of, you know, I do help a lot with kind of building initial budgets, but that's about as in the weeds as I get in terms of finance. It was easy in the sense that I think, you know, I was prepared for, you know, sort of the rigor of the job, but it was difficult in the sense that, you know, I had a thesis around cybersecurity. One of the reasons I was so excited to join YL was I'd worked on a IPO for a company that had been doing a lot of acquisitions in cyberspace. And my job as the associate was to essentially write the box and business section for the S1, for the prospectus for the IPO. And so I had to learn a lot about cybersecurity because I had to kind of tell this story about it, right? And so I had sort of developed a thesis, but I was by no means, and still candidly, by no means I'm a subject matter expert in cybersecurity. I think at this point, you know, I can kind of hold my own, but you know, it's not as if I had been a CISO in a prior life, or, you know, I've been kind of a practitioner. And I think that it's an industry that's incredibly complex. It's an industry that's incredibly innovative. There's a lot of jargon. And so it took me a while, I think, to just get facile with a lot of the terminology, to just get comfortable with kind of speaking the language, to be able to understand the competitive landscape. And so the learning curve, I would say, was steep from a subject matter perspective, if that makes sense.
Yeah. How do you manage that today? Just like transparently, I've noticed something similar personally, where, you know, I've been in cyber now for 5 or 6 years, but you know, still struggle with some of the jargon, or, you know, look at a company's website that I'm, you know, considering interviewing for the podcast or something, and it doesn't really click. It's like, what the hell does they do?
Here's what you gotta remember, Joe, is that that's not your fault. That's their fault. So I think one of the problems, seriously though, I think one of the issues I have in this space is there's this old cliche or this old joke, and I hope I don't offend anybody by saying this, but it's the old joke is if engineers had started KFC, they would have called it Hot Dead Birds. And marketing, I think, is one of the things that's hardest for a lot of technically minded people to kind of wrap their head around. And again, it's such an opaque and difficult space for a lot of people to understand. I think a lot of marketing teams kind of fall back on a lot of familiar language. And what ends up happening is that a lot of companies are sort of described in very similar ways. And so if you walk the floor at RSA or Black Hat, or you're looking at websites, it's really, really difficult in a lot of cases to be able to drill down into, you know, what do you actually do? You know, it's like that scene in Office Space. Like, what would you say you do here? You know? And it's really hard. So I don't think that's a you problem. I think that's sort of an industry problem. To answer your question, what do I do? A lot of it is what I did when I first started, which was, you know, consuming a lot of media, particularly podcasts. I started listening to Defense in Depth and a lot of the stuff David Spark was doing when I first started. That was really helpful to me because I think a lot of people in the podcasting space, you know, yourself included, make it, I think, a little bit more approachable and a little less academic, and hearing from practitioners. Another way, you know, I think getting really involved, we started doing a CISO in residence program shortly after I joined, where, you know, we have a former practicing CISO join us for a period of time, usually around a year, and he or she, you know, comes on as sort of a full-time employee at YL, and really, you know, trying to align myself to that role, trying to be involved in what a lot of those people are doing, trying to be in kind of all of those conversations. And again, just kind of learning through osmosis has been really helpful to me. And I've taken on a lot of additional responsibilities with respect to our CISO advisory board since I've joined as well. And that's been tremendously helpful. So it's really just a lot of podcasts, a lot of kind of media, and then a lot of just kind of trying to have as many conversations as I can with practitioners. That's what works for me.
Yeah. And as you've just kind of educated yourself, right, through all those mechanisms you just described, how has your investment thesis shifted or evolved over the years, if at all?
Yeah, that's a good question. I guess I would say it hasn't fundamentally shifted or changed in one way or another, but it's continually shifting, if that makes sense. And the reason I say that is, you know, we're a sector focused VC firm, right? We only do cybersecurity and maybe, I guess, what you could consider cybersecurity adjacent things. If you think about, you know, things like privacy as being, you know, not necessarily traditionally purely cyber, but certainly cyber adjacent. What that means is that in order to diversify our portfolio while avoiding, you know, direct conflict or overlap, we have to really try to uncover or turn over every rock, you know, when it comes to new sectors within cybersecurity, underinvested sectors within cybersecurity. And so I think that has always been consistent, but I think the areas that we look at, you know, kind of continuously change. And I think we try to rely really on, you know, our practitioners, our advisory board, people in the market, customers really, right, at the end of the day, to kind of be telling us, you know, where we should be making our bets. We try to make it more of a pull from the market rather than kind of a push based on our theses, if that makes sense.
I see. Okay. So it's you guys have kind of built out the infrastructure to, you know, tell you where the puck is going rather than you sit there looking into your crystal ball, anticipating where it will go. It's kind of the...
I think so. Yeah, exactly. I think that's a great way to put it. You know, I think, and that's what, you know, I think this advisory board in particular has been instrumental in kind of helping us do, is understand where there are gaps, where there are efficiencies, what solutions or problem spaces are kind of ripe for disruption, where are people unsatisfied or pissed off at kind of the current solutions, what's something that, you know, is maybe coming down the pike from a technological standpoint that doesn't have a solution today. You know, a company like Twistlock, I think, is a good example of that. So kind of a container security company of ours that was sold in 2019. You know, that was a story of, you know, this was a relatively new technology that was going to kind of require specific security solutions going forward. And that was sort of a bet, you know, based on where we thought, like you said, where we thought the puck was going. But that thesis was very much informed by what I think we were hearing from the market. And so I think that's what we try to do today going forward.
Yeah. So when you think about like the criteria of what creates an investable company beyond, you know, intel from, you know, the advisory committee or just, you know, resources that you guys have, what are other criteria that are really important to you when you think about just an investable business?
Yeah. You know, it's an interesting question in investable business, because I think that as seed investors, you know, we're not really, truthfully, we're not really investing in companies. We're investing in people. And I think it sounds a little cliche, but I think it's 100% true. What is cliche is this, you know, there's this old analogy of the jockey and the horse. You know, are you betting on the jockey or are you betting on the horse? And in the case of this analogy, you know, the jockey being the founding team, the founders, and the horse being, you know, the company or the idea. I think at the seed stage, it's probably 90% about the jockey, in all honesty. And so I think, you know, there certainly has to be an investable idea, right? We validate the problem space. We validate the total addressable market. We try to get, you know, founders that we work with in front of, you know, many, you know, dozens in some cases, CISOs to understand, you know, is this a really big opportunity? But it's 90% about the team, because you know that you're going to have to pivot. You know that the MVP is, you know, still to be determined. And so we're really betting on people. And, you know, I think we're looking for passion, for creativity, for intelligence, for ethics, and the ability, I think, to synthesize, you know, feedback and information quickly and turn that back around. So that's another reason why, you know, these kind of, I'll call them diligence calls, but they're really sort of customer discovery calls we do as part of our diligence process. So the reason why that's so important is to see how founders kind of respond to those conversations.
But it's
really, I would say 90%, you know, the team, do we have comfort with the team and confidence in the team? And then 10%, you know, do we think this is a potentially a big opportunity?
Yeah. I'd love to maybe talk about and better understand what I guess we can just call sort of your process, and specifically when it comes to, you know, ensuring that you're seeing the best deals, and best ideas, best early companies. I know obviously YL has an incredible brand and very strong recognition in the cyber world. So I'm sure that helps, but, how do you just think about ensuring that you see the best deals?
Yeah. So it's a great question. Because it's really, I don't want to sound overly simplistic, but that's really what our success depends on fundamentally, right? Is just meeting the best founders at the right time and convincing them that we're the right partner. And I think a lot of it goes back to that sole focus. So, you know, we are admittedly a niche firm, right, in terms of strategy. I mean, being, you know, sector focused, geographically focused, stage focused, being almost, I think, you know, maniacally focused in some ways on trying to be the best in the world at one thing, right? Seed stage, cybersecurity investing. It means that we've built a lot of processes in place, I think, to support that really specific vision. And I think being focused on only one market and only one sector is really what allows us to do that. So we've got, I think, 20 full-time employees here at Wild Ventures. The majority of them are based in Tel Aviv. We've got an insiders network of former and current entrepreneurs, industry leaders in cybersecurity who act almost as sort of like a scouting network. You know, we have our current and former portfolio who act as amazing references to us and amazing sources for potential leads, people that are, you know, considering starting a security startup, people that are looking for co-founders, et cetera. We have an amazing team on the ground in Tel Aviv that ensures that, you know, we're talking to everybody who's considering building a big company in cybersecurity. And so I think having that, those sort of boots on the ground, so to speak, you know, that kind of sourcing mechanism, I think is paramount. And that's all run by my amazing partner, Ofer Schreiber, who kind of runs the whole Tel Aviv office. And Ofer and his team and everybody over there, you know, are that's the way we succeed, right? Is making sure that we're having these conversations. And we also say, you know, it's never too early to kind of engage with Wild Ventures. We talk to many people when it's, you know, a single person looking for co-founders or a team that's formed, but they don't have an idea yet. You know, we'll talk to anybody at any stage of their journey because we want to make sure that we're getting in front of the right people. We want to make sure that we're kind of convincing them over the course of building that relationship that we're the right partners. And in terms of, you know, maybe in terms of winning deals, you know, I think it really comes down to, you know, our reputation, hopefully, as you alluded to, you know, our track record. And then I think, you know, our team and our and the value add resources that our team brings to the table. You know, so we try to make everybody at our firm available to each one of our portfolio companies. You know, we don't have sort of a deal specific structure where I work on my companies and John and Yoav and Ofer work on their companies. And we do everything kind of collectively as a unit. And what we're trying to do is bring all of our perspectives, all of our different skill sets to bear to our entire portfolio company, to our entire portfolio. And I think that, you know, hopefully we're able to convince people that, you know, it can really be a big multiplier in terms of what they're trying to do, especially trying to act as sort of that connective tissue between, you know, the Israeli market, founder market, and sort of the US business side of things.
Yeah. I know we started talking about that a bit before we began recording, but I'd love to maybe just hear a little bit more about the focus on Israeli businesses specifically, just maybe how that came to be as, you know, the firm was getting started and just how you think about that as like a core tenet of the firm structure.
Sure. So, you know, our founder, managing partner, Yoav Leitersdorf, Israeli serial entrepreneur himself. I think he started his first business, he was about 16 or 17, I think, when he was in high school. And it's kind of started and sold a couple of different companies. And I think that, you know, he really started YL because, you know, I think he wanted to be, I'm going to put words in his mouth, but I think this is true. I think, you know, he really wanted to build a platform to help other entrepreneurs like himself kind of along the same path to kind of find a way into the US market, to find a way to build big businesses here. And again, trying to kind of bridge that gap between the amazing Israeli entrepreneurial community, you know, Startup Nation, the book Startup Nation about how, you know, many amazing startups come out of Israel, kind of bridging that gap between that amazing sort pool of talent and then kind of, you know, the business opportunities here in the United States. I think that was sort of the fundamental motivation for why we do what we do and where we do it. You know, cybersecurity has always been a focus of the firm. I think it's become a specialty and really a sole focus over the last few years. But, you know, rather than, I would say, again, going back to sort of the strategy, rather than making, you know, a lot of small bets, you know, we do a relatively small number of really high conviction plays in this sort of narrow field. So we're only doing, you know, 2 to 4 new deals per year, right? That's sort of our strategy. And again, part of that is because that's the only way we can scale when we're kind of bringing our entire firm's focus to bear on each new investment, right? There's only so many of us. There's only, you know, you can only make so many of those bets and really give every company the attention that they need and that they deserve. And I think that focusing in one geography really allows us to make sure that we're partnering with the best founders. You know, the ability to do deep references on people, the ability to spend real genuine time with them face to face. You can't replicate that, I think, if you are in a lot of different geographies. If I think about it practically, if I was investing in seed stage companies in Israel and the US and other parts of Europe and Central and South America, there would just be no way that I could get the level of kind of personal relationship building, but also kind of the background references, just the conviction that I have around, you know, this is a team that is worth backing. This is a jockey that I want to bet on. There'd be no way to do that. Or certainly I can't think of a way to do that. You know, to the degree that we're able to, by having that kind of sole focus in Israel and sole focus kind of in cybersecurity.
Yeah.
So
there's something you said a moment ago that I'd love to dig into a bit. Specifically about, you know, the firm only doing a handful of investments a year, two to four. You know, I've talked with other investors that have a little bit of a different approach at the early stage. You know, their philosophy is more kind of the shots on goal argument of, you know, the odds will get better if they have more shots on goal, especially at the very early stage. So I'd love to maybe just hear your perspective on that, you know, just concentrating in, you know, a handful of names that are very high conviction.
Yeah. Look, I mean, both strategies can work. And I think both strategies have their pluses and minuses. I think I'm biased. you know, I guess I have an N of one. This is the way that I've always done it. And this is kind of what, you know, what I believe in. I'll say the reason, one of the reasons why I really like this model is, you know, we are the lead investor in every deal that we do. We're the first institutional capital in every deal that we do. That's sort of non-negotiable. But having that kind of sector specific focus, having that really, that model where we really need conviction, doing a handful of new deals per year, in some ways, I believe it allows us to de-risk our investments. So rather than looking at it just as shots on goal or kind of like, you know, playing roulette, I guess, to a certain degree, right? Where you're just kind of placing bets. I really look at it as more a smaller number of portfolio companies and more hands-on involvement with each of them allows me in some ways to almost try to make each investment, I don't want to say fail-proof, nothing's fail-proof, but, you know, de-risk them. And really the onus is on us as a firm to do that through all of our value add programs. So I think Yoav would say, you know, we're very proud of the fact that we've only had one write-off in our entire portfolio history. And I think that, you know, everybody who was here for that remembers how painful that was. And I think that, you know, our ability to bring, again, an enormous community to bear to each investment we do and kind of focus fanatically on each one and have really high conviction around each bet we make, you know, hopefully allows that success rate to be much, much higher. Both strategies can work. You know, this is the way that I've always done it. I think personally, this way is a little bit more fun too, from the VC perspective, because, you know, again, I get to really feel like I'm watching and hopefully helping, you know, all of our founders from day one, you know, build big, exciting, interesting companies and do that almost, you know, I hope to be, you know, kind of a true partner as they're doing that, or almost kind of like a third or fourth co-founder in some ways. So it's really, I think, a lot more fun and, you know, it's worked for us, so.
You know, on the subject of value add services and maybe how it is that you support those organizations that you've invested in, I know, you know, your sort of primary focus for supporting operating companies is on go to market. So I'd love to maybe talk about that for a bit. And, you know, as a sort of introductory question, understand, you know, when you reflect on, you know, the organizations that you've supported thus far, which one had, you don't have to name the name unless you're comfortable, but which one had the best go-to-market process and what made it great?
So I think any questions that are sort of company specific are tough because it's almost like asking a parent to choose their favorite child. So it's a little, it's a little tough.
Well, let's scrap that part. Yeah. And just focus on like, what did it look like?
I'll tell you a little bit about, I think what, broadly, again, we'll go going back to the pattern recognition point, broadly what I think helps and makes companies succeed. Number one, you know, really quick time to value. To be able to articulate what your company does and demonstrate some value in a very short time frame, I think is critical. So the best companies or the best go-to-market processes are ones where you have a POV or some sort of demo where you might even be able to plug in literally in the span of a 1 hour call, maybe using read-only access to get something and show some sort of discovery or some sort of you know, process improvement or whatever it is, but to be able to do that very quickly to demonstrate A, that the technology works, and B, that you're able to uncover or improve something in a very short amount of time. Now, at the same time, you've got to balance that between being sticky, right? Because if the whole value of your product is able to be demonstrated and articulated in 1 hour, why is somebody necessarily going to renew, right? If you can get all the value out of what you're doing in 45 minutes. But balancing that between here's something we can do really quickly, and then here's how we can kind of grow with you on a journey, you know, as a customer, I think the best companies are ones that are able to kind of balance those two things. I think that kind of makes for really important go-to-market. The other thing I would say is being able to tie what you do to business value in some way. Understand that, you know, you're going to have a champion for your tool. What, maybe it's the CISO, maybe it's the head of AppSec, whomever it is, right, within the customer. You're going to have a champion. But that person, in most cases, is not going to be the sole decision maker. And they're not going to be the only person that you've got to kind of win over throughout the go-to-market process, right? There's going to be engineering people, that, you know, DevOps people, procurement, right? Or a CIO, a CFO, whomever. And so if you look at it through that lens and you think about it as, what can I give to my champion to basically make them my best salesperson, to basically empower them? You know, the best go-to-market motions are the ones where I think if you think about it from that point of view and you think, I want my champion, whoever he or she is, to be rewarded or get adulation or get a promotion based on buying my company. Like that's the pinnacle, right? That's the holy grail. So if you can articulate that, tie it to business value and show how it can make them look good, I think you're going to find a lot more success and you're going to find a lot more kind of sticky customer relationships, because they're going to really feel like you helped them. It wasn't just ticking a box on the security roadmap. I was really kind of helping them on a personal level as well. So I think that those are two things that just stick out to me as sort of the best companies, again, sort of matching that quick time to value with, you know, what's the longer journey for how to kind of make that sticky, and then aligning to business cases or business value and kind of helping kind of your champion become almost like a salesperson or an evangelist, you know, for what you're trying to do within their company, and understanding what those pain points are, pressure points are, what things that they're struggling with internally, and try to unlock that. I think that's where I see companies have the most success, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, very much with you on those two points. And maybe just to look at it from the other side of the coin, what are sort of the most common go-to-market challenges that you see organizations face?
I think for early stage startups, I think there's a tendency to over-index on one or two, you know, early customers or pieces of feedback you've gotten. I think when you're trying so hard to get traction, you know, every yes you get, I think you have a tendency to sort of magnify that in your mind. And every no that you get, you have a tendency to sort of magnify that in your mind. And so it can become kind of a little bit of an emotional roller coaster. And I think sometimes companies make a mistake in, again, over-indexing towards one or two yeses and thinking, oh, well, if I build this feature or if we adjust our roadmap to kind of solve this one particular customer's need, you know, maybe they'll be our first paying customer. And they forget that, like, what if that person quits? What if the person gets fired? What if that company has like a downside? You know what I mean? If you're shifting your entire kind of business model to one or two edge cases, you know, you're putting yourself at risk, right? You're pinning a lot of hopes on kind of one or two things that, for whatever reason, maybe completely out of your control, might not lead to a sale. So that's kind of one mistake or one challenge. I think the other challenge is, you know, most founders don't have a sales background or a go-to-market background themselves. And it's an unnatural, uncomfortable muscle, I think, for a lot of people when they're starting out. And they've got to realize that for the first 6, 12, maybe 18 months, like, it's going to be a founder-led sales motion, like it or not. You know, you're not going to hire your first true sales leader, marketing leader, you know, or you shouldn't, in my opinion, until you've got some indication of product market fit and you're really ready to kind of turn on the jets a little bit. And so it's going to be on you. And I think a lot of times people are just a little uncomfortable, you know, being, I would say, aggressive without being pushy. I think that's hard for a lot of people when they're first starting out, and building in the rigor and the discipline around organization, you know, taking notes, lining up next steps, being able to kind of match what you're hearing from all your customer discovery conversations and getting a kind of a feedback loop with product and with the R&D team on what we need to be building and how that kind of all fits into the roadmap. I think just building those muscles is just hard for a lot of people when they're first starting out.
Yeah. No, it's one of the, I think probably the most common challenge I hear of all the CEOs and founders I talk to is technical background, and they've got to learn how to sell. Especially when the company's brand new. So.
Yeah. And I guess maybe one last point sort of tangentially is, this kind of goes back to the point about marketing, but being able to kind of pitch, right? Just being able to, and again, tying into, to the business value, I think a lot of founders, they build things that they get so excited about technologically, or they're so keen to explain why this thing is cool or why their baby is the cutest, you know, that they don't always necessarily understand what the customer, what the person on the other side of the phone is really trying to solve. Hmm. And they don't always do a good job of tying the technology back to that pain point. You know, they kind of almost look at it as like, this is an opportunity to show off this cool thing I built. And they don't bother to ask, you know, like, let's start the conversation with what challenges are you facing? And then let me try to, you know, fit my narrative to address that. I join a lot of these calls. You know, I've seen people, you know, sometimes go 8-10 minutes without taking a breath, without stopping to let the customer talk, you know. It's kind of amazing, but yeah, it just doesn't come natural to a lot of people, and it takes time.
It's a very, very funny parallel, but you know, when I have my sales leader hat on, it's actually the most common challenge I see with new account executives who are coming out of training. Mm. And in that, after the training, they're very enthusiastic about this product that they now know everything about, right? Yeah. They just want to talk about it and describe how amazing it is to you. But then when you ask them a fundamental question, all right, why are they talking to us? Right? What are they trying to solve for by potentially working with us and using our products? It's just, you know, deer in the headlights. Interesting 100%. Parallel. Yeah.
Yeah, 100%.
Okay. Well, I'd love to maybe pivot a bit and kind of zoom back out and look at things from, you know, market perspective. I'm curious to get your thoughts on, you know, other investors I've talked to have, you know, spoken about overcapitalization in cyber, and specifically just kind of a supply and demand issue, right? Obviously, there's a huge demand to invest in cybersecurity businesses, but relatively low supply, right, of organizations that fit the bill, and this leads to a lot of noise in the market. So I'm curious just to hear your point of view on that. What if you agree, disagree, and just what your general perspective would be on kind of overcapitalization in cyber?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, I'd be curious to have this debate with some of those other investors, or at least to understand their point of view. And I'd also be curious at what stage they're investing. You know, I think that I think over the last couple of years, there was sort of a boom in terms of investing in cybersecurity. And there were a lot of businesses getting funded at the seed stage and at the growth stage alike that probably didn't have the fundamental product market fit to be able to justify that. So I think that there was a little bit of a gold rush. I don't think, though, that was specific to cybersecurity necessarily. It was certainly true in cybersecurity, but I think you could make the same arguments about fintech. I think you can make the same arguments about a lot of sectors, crypto, Web3 investing within the VC community. I think you can make a similar argument in a lot of different domains. So I don't think that there is a overcapitalization problem specific to cybersecurity. I think that there was in the VC community in general, and I think that you are seeing and will continue to see a little bit of a reckoning, you know, over the next year, 18 months. I don't know how long it'll be. If I knew that, I'd be retired. But but there will be a reckoning, you know, about that. But I don't think that that's a cybersecurity specific issue. And if anything, I think that the sort of arms race dynamic of our industry of cybersecurity, you know, attackers and defenders and the constant need for innovation, you know, will continue to drive a need for new solutions and will continue to drive a need for additional investment. And I think it's still an amazing time to start a new company. I guess that's how I would kind of answer that question.
Yeah. And with that, you know, I'm sure, you know, maybe it hasn't changed too much at the seed stage. You know, your characteristics of what you're looking for are probably still pretty constant, but I'd love to hear maybe how it is at all that your just approach has shifted or dynamics have shifted, you know, over the last maybe 6 or 12 months. And if it's not, if there's nothing really different at the seed stage, maybe more on the kind of follow-on or portfolio stage.
Yeah, I think nothing's fundamentally changed from our strategy. You know, in fact, I think last year was our busiest year ever in terms of net new investment. You know, we just raised a new fund the beginning part of last year that we're investing out of now. And seed investors, you know, we're really trying to take 3, 5, 7 year bets anyway. And so we're a little bit, not immune, but insulated from, you know, what's happening in the public markets. It's kind of like if you imagine making this up, so maybe bear with me with this analogy if this falls apart. But if you throw a stone into a pond, right, and there's this sort of ripples, concentric circles, you know, and the stone is sort of some macro event. You know, the public markets closest to that, I think, feel that the most, right? The ripple is the big, the wave is the biggest, and then we're kind of all the way at the outside of the circle. So we're not immune to it, but we're less impacted, I would say. Again, because we're taking sort of these longer term views. Maybe on the margin, I would say, you know, similar to the beginning of the pandemic, you know, all companies are taking another look at their budget. They're building in some scenario analysis. You know, if these deals end up slipping one quarter, you know, if this one thing that we thought was a lock doesn't materialize, you know, what hiring might we push out, you know, one or two quarters? What product development might we delay as sort of like a nice to have, not a need to have? Where can we cut back maybe on some marketing spend or some travel, you know, just kind of building in more kind of scenarios, I think, from a finance perspective. We are doing that, you know, at the seed stage, I think more than maybe on the margin, you know, just building a little bit more buffer, just given sort of the uncertainty. But fundamentally, you know, it's pretty much, I would say, business as usual at the seed stage.
Yeah, cool. All right. Well, I'd love to transition into the rapid fire round, which basic premise is I ask you a few quick questions and you share whatever comes top of mind. Sound good?
All right. I'll do it.
Cool. All right. So first question, what's your favorite book?
Favorite book. Does that be like one word answers? I don't have a favorite book. I would say anything by Bill Bryson, Michael Lewis, or Eric Larson. I have read or will read.
Cool. All right. Next one. If you could change anything about the cyber investing industry, what would it be?
Anything about the cyber investing industry? I would probably say like more alignment between technology and business value and better rigor around making sure that the investments you're making are really aligned to solving real business problems and aren't just kind of cool technology, you know, not just cool tech stopping advanced cyber threats, but like a better articulation of how I think security tools can address business problems and a lot more rigor around proving that thesis with customer conversations.
Yeah. Who's someone in the industry that you really admire?
Oh, a lot. Too many people to count. Too risky to hurt feelings. I would say that all of the CISO in residence we've had over the years. So, you know, starting with Roger Hale, Sunil Yu, Ryan Gurney, and now Frank Kim. I think all four of those are people that I really, really admire and respect and have learned a tremendous amount from.
Cool. Yeah. I've had Frank and Roger on the show. Roger was one of my first interviews.
Yeah. Amazing. Yeah. Great guys. Super smart. Way smarter than I am. And all people that I think have diverse backgrounds, bring a lot of different perspectives to the table, people I really admire quite a bit.
Yeah, cool. What's something you know now that you wish you knew at the beginning of your investing career?
What's something I know now? I guess I would say that, you know, although VC is in some ways a very individualistic career, requires a lot of working independently, that it's okay to constantly ask for help and for advice. I think that's one thing I wish I had known or appreciated more when I was starting. I think the most successful people in any industry, really, including VC, are people that are humble enough to know that they don't know everything, wise enough to ask questions, learn from other people. I think sometimes it's easy in this industry to feel like you have all the answers or you should have all the answers. And so I think that would be my advice to my former self.
Yeah, cool. Well, you started to answer this one a bit. So maybe we see if there's a backup or make it more personal or something. But last sure. question is, if you could go back in time and get a drink with your 20-year-old self, what advice would you give him?
Oh, man, when I was 20. When I was 20, it was 2006. I was in college, and it was before the global financial crisis had really kind of kicked everybody's ass. I graduated in 2008, so when that was just sort of peaking. You know, at the time, I naively thought I was going to go into Wall Street. You know, I went to undergrad at Fordham University in New York and LSE in London, and I thought, you know, I'll get a career in Wall Street. And, you know, come to find out, graduating in 2008, that was pretty impossible, essentially impossible. So I think the advice I would give to myself is, you know, just kind of try to run your own race, man. You know, I mean, everybody's got different strengths, different weaknesses, different advantages, disadvantages, different backstories, different personal, you know, histories. And I think it's tempting to look at life. And I think it's tempting to look at your career in particular as sort of this race that you're running against peers. You know, you're looking ahead, you're looking behind, you're looking next to you in the lane over. And maybe something like rock climbing or like a different sport is maybe a better analogy. You know, I think it's more about maximizing what you're capable of and being satisfied that every day, you know, you're working towards that. I think that would be the advice I would give myself.
Yeah, love it. Well, if you bump into 20-year-old me, give him the same advice, please.
Yeah, so. Yeah, we'll do.
Yeah, cool. All right, Michael, this has been awesome, man. Thank you so much for taking the time. I really enjoyed having the chance to meet with you and chat with you today.
Yeah, likewise, Joe. Thanks so much for the opportunity.